Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. We're talking today about the dead zone in the Chesapeake Bay. That's the area where so little oxygen dissolved in the water, it's dangerous for plants and animals, sometimes downright deadly. Last month, the Bay's dead zone stretched to record levels. The Bay Journal reported that the area of low oxygen water grew to about 1.65 cubic miles. Is that right? 1.65 cubic miles in late July, and noticed this was the seventh largest dead zone ever recorded for that time of year. The summer began with promising figures. The dead zone was smaller than usual in June, the second smallest for early summer since 1985, and now conditions have returned to the normal range for August. Today we want to take a deep dive into the dead zone. How does it affect plant and animal life in the Bay? What impact will climate change have on its size? And are Maryland and surrounding states doing enough to ensure healthy oxygen levels in Chesapeake Bay? I'm joined by Dr. Don Bosch, a biological oceanographer, professor of marine science, and president of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, which operates laboratories across the state. Thanks so much for being here.
It's good to be here, Sheila.
Good to see you. And also with us is Tim Wheeler, longtime environmental reporter and now managing editor of The Bay Journal. The Bay Journal covers environmental issues related to Chesapeake Bay, from climate change and pollution to fisheries and wildlife. You can find their coverage at bayjournal.com. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be here, Sheila.
So how big, Don Bosch, is this dead zone? Where is it, for starters? What part of the Bay?
Okay. So the what's called the dead zone is an area where the oxygen levels get critically low, to a level where it really doesn't allow larger animals and so on to live. So that area is not throughout the whole bay, but it's in deeper parts of the bay. So below the first, say, 15 feet, you wouldn't see this. It's have to go deeper. And it is the deeper waters of the bay from here near Baltimore all the way down well into Virginia, the areas that can get critically low in oxygen levels during the summer.
Okay, I'm not a scientist, and if you told me to guess where oxygen has trouble staying dissolved in water, I would have thought it would be the deep parts of the bay that would keep its oxygen.
Well, that's what you might think, but that the reality is that the deeper parts of the bay become depleted in oxygen because all of this biological production that's stimulated by the nutrient pollution we've created in the bay falls down into the deeper water, and as that decomposes, it draws down the oxygen levels. Coupled with that, especially during the summer months, the surface waters are warmer than the cooler bottom waters. They're also a little fresher. So that means that water is less dense than the deeper,
upper levels of water.
The upper waters are less dense than the bottom waters. So there's a stratification that prohibits the mixing of the water, the reoxygenation of the bottom waters, plus all of this biological production then consuming the oxygen out of those waters. Those two factors, the stratification and the excessive amount of biological production, that cause the dead zone.
Tim Wheeler, Don Bosch just mentioned the nutrients, as if we all know about nutrients in the Bay. And many of our listeners, I'm sure, do. But I'm going to ask you to give us the primer on nutrients. To many people, sound like a good thing. We look
Bay
for nutrients in our own diets. It's not a good thing in the Bay.
Well, too much of a good thing is bad for us, as anybody who goes on a diet can tell you. And nutrients are just the same thing as too much food. They're plant food, and it's nitrogen and phosphorus. And
they come from where?
Well, they come from multiple sources. Some of that comes from waste, animal waste, human waste. Some of it comes from our cars and our power plants. And some of it is just there in nature already. It's an organic material that decomposes. So a normal amount of that stuff, the ecosystem can handle. It processes it. It needs it. But when we have too much, we get what Don called the biological production. We get, you know, what I call big algae blooms out there. The water gets really murky. It's full of microscopic plant life. When that stuff reaches a certain level, it dies off. And when it drops to the bottom and starts to decompose, that's what's sucking up the oxygen. So it's a sort of a, you know, it keeps feeding on itself.
But it's the decomposition of the algae that is the real thief of the oxygen?
Pretty much.
That's correct. So the things that decompose it are some animals, but largely bacteria. You know, just like if we were composting waste in your backyard, it's the bacterial processes which break down the organic matter and in the process consume oxygen and release carbon dioxide, just like we do when we respire.
Well, could we then try to control this theft of oxygen by harvesting the algae? Could we just pull it out of the bay before it starts decomposing?
I'm sure somebody's thought about that. It would be a monumental undertaking, and I'm not sure how you could do it.
Well, I have no idea. I just thought of it. But I raise it because...
Talk to the governor about that.
I raise it because the approach that we, meaning Maryland, meaning its neighboring states, meaning the federal EPA, is taking to try to control the nutrients and preserve more oxygen is pretty monumental also.
Sure.
I mean, we're trying to stop or limit nutrients getting into the bay, which is a problem for a lot of farmers all throughout this huge watershed.
Well, I guess it's going on the philosophy that prevention, an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure, because it's, you know, the idea is if you can cut down on how much of that stuff is getting in the water, then you're not going to have problems in the water, or as many. But you're right. I mean, it's coming from practically everywhere. It's runoff from farmland, where fertilizer and animal manure are used to grow crops. It's runoff from urban and suburban lawns that use lawn fertilizer. It's a runoff from streets with pet waste and material that's dropped on the streets and in alleys and parking lots. So, you know, it is, and it's coming from the air. A lot of it's coming from the air, from our own burning of fossil fuels and other things that are generating some of the nitrogen that's ultimately drops back down to the ground. So it is a challenge. But, you know, there have been people who have looked at, you know, engineering solutions to the pollution. There was one environment secretary a few years back, more than a few decades back now, who had the bright idea that maybe if we just put a lot of little whirligigs in the water to churn it up. You know, he was talking about how there's oxygen at the top and not at the bottom. If you stirred up the water, maybe that would put the oxygen back down there and everything would be cool. But again, it's that problem of scale.
Well, did we try the whirligigs?
We do that on smaller scale. Like if you live in a creek that has an oxygen problem, it causes fish kills because of the same process as we talked about. You can buy aerators and aerate those, putting air, you know, injecting it in, and it mixes the water. But at scale, when you're talking about something as large as the bay, with all of the tidal forces back and forth, that process doesn't work. But the other point you raised, can't we kind of use something to remove the algae? You know, we're actually trying to do that in a number of ways, innovative ways, but it's, again, it's limited by the scale of the challenge. For example, we're trying to grow more oysters, you know, that filter feed and remove that algae. We are also working on biofuels. Can we use the fact that we have these waste nutrients and grow algae that we can harvest in some sort of a culture facility to produce biofuels, renewable energy?
Actually turn it into a money-making, a positive operation.
Yes, reduce a problem and make money and help decarbonize, you know, with respect to fossil fuels, our energy economy.
You mentioned oysters, and that reminds me that I want to ask you before we get into more about how the efforts to control this are working and why or why not. We haven't really talked about the impact. You mentioned fish kills. What is the impact of a dead zone?
Well, it has multiple impacts. Fish kills can be one of them, but often since this develops slowly over the early part of the summer, the fish that can will avoid it. So you don't necessarily see a lot of dead bodies. Plus, as I said, this is 15 feet below the surface. You know, the average person or any person who's out on the bay sailing or fishing probably doesn't see it unless they dip their line down 15 feet into this dead water and they're not catching any fish. So it's kind of invisible in that sense. But it has really pervasive ecological effects. as Tim pointed out, it kind of makes this vicious cycle, accelerates the vicious cycle. So the organic matter goes to the bottom. It doesn't all decompose. It releases the nutrients. And when the oxygen is depleted, it causes more of those nutrients to come back up, fueling the fire of this production again. So we know that this is really has a really critical...
So the dead zone perpetuates itself.
Yes, it does. It has a feedback loop that actually makes it work worse. Now, we hope that, and the science tells us, that if we rein back, we pull back on the nutrient loads, we'll see that feedback loop and that threshold effect kind of work in our advantage. And that's where we thought we were, and we think we're headed to with respect to the improvements that we're seeing, so that we get to the point where there's enough oxygen to prevent that perverse feedback loop working, and things start to improve rather dramatically. And so we were on a trajectory where the dead zone is progressively getting better and better every year. And this year we thought, wow, it looks pretty good in the first half of the summer. Maybe we're at this threshold. And the natural processes of the intense heat that we had in July and now into August kind of taught us a lesson that it's the heat, baby. Think about that we need to understand that has an effect on the dead zone in two ways. One is the warmer the water is, the faster the decomposition is. It accelerates the metabolic rate in which the biology is working. And secondly, remember I talked about the surface waters being less dense. Mm-hmm. Because it's warmer? Well, it makes it even warmer and less dense, and so it caps the dead zone more effectively as the surface water warms during a heat wave during the summer.
Yeah, this is an interesting point, because I guess one of the issues in the past has been the connection was strongly made that the amount of precipitation you have drives more nutrients off the land into the water and feeds this vicious cycle. And so we've had a relatively dry period for the last few years. And there was, a lot of puzzlement about how much of the improvement we're seeing is weather related and how much is because we're making progress. Now you obviously have to think about, obviously, temperature also is the other factor here, in terms of cooking this stuff. So even if there's not as much rainfall as you've had to push more in, what's already there is maybe going to be more likely to cause problems in hotter weather.
And I want to make sure I'm understanding the significance of temperature before current temperature.
Right.
I want to talk about climate change later, but warm water dissolves less or more oxygen than cool water?
The warmer the water is, the less oxygen it can contain, the maximum amount of oxygen. So the warmer water, if it becomes warmer, the oxygen levels, even if it's, as much oxygen as it could contain, is less than water that's slightly less warmer. So it has warmer temperatures.
The sun baking the bay.
It will hold less oxygen, plus the processes. The bacteria work overtime with warmer temperatures and remove the remaining oxygen faster under warmer conditions.
So just because of that, one expects some kind of dead zone, or the dead zone, whatever dead zone there's going to be worse in the middle of summer.
Yes, that is indeed a factor. But we've been developing these forecasts that have been produced based upon, as Tim said, the amount of river flow that we have in the amount of nutrients coming down into the bay during the spring is a good predictor. But that's based upon the assumption that it won't get excessively hot during the summer. And, of course, this year we had a hotter than normal
summer. No one's
summer.
Making that assumption anymore.
No, well, yes.
We're going to talk more about all of this. We need to take a short break, and we'll continue talking about the dead zone in Chesapeake Bay. You are welcome to join this conversation. Do you make your living on the bay? Have you seen an impact from nutrient runoff and the dead zone? Tell us about it. Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Without oxygen, plant and animal life in Chesapeake Bay can suffocate and die. Areas of low oxygen water known as dead zones fluctuate in size as the seasons change. Late last month, the dead zone in Chesapeake Bay was one of the largest on record. The area has now returned to typical conditions for this time of year. With me to discuss dead zones and what they mean for the health of the bay are Dr. Don Bosch, president of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, and longtime environmental reporter and managing editor for The Bay Journal, Tim Wheeler. You can be part of this conversation. Have you been out on the bay this summer? Did you go fishing or crabbing? What did you notice about the health of the water? Did you notice anything different from previous years? Send us an email at midday at WYPR.org or phone us 410-662-8780. Don Bosch, I want to pick up on, you mentioned in passing something about oysters. And you talked also about fish when they pick up that the oxygen in this part of in the water I'm in is not good. They move out of it. But there are lots of living things in the bay that we treasure that can't move.
Right. So there are things. So fish and crabs, to a certain degree, can move out of the way. If they do get trapped to go with this oxygen overcomes them, the low oxygen overcomes them, they can die. The oysters, of course, are fixed in place for the rest of their lives. And so there we have lost some of the deeper oyster beds in the bay because not only of the problems of over-harvesting and so on, but also because of the oxygen levels are now regularly too low for the oysters to survive. And so we are concerned about the low oxygen conditions also being a factor in our challenge to restore the oysters in the bay as well.
Are there other, do other bodies of water have dead zones? Are we accepting something in Chesapeake Bay that other places don't accept?
No, they're actually this phenomenon of dead zones, so-called, happened. Some of them have naturally occurred and existed for millennia. The Black Sea, for example, it's got a deep basin that's isolated. That's why it's called the Black Sea because of hydrogen sulfide that can come up. But there are many areas in coastal regions around the world, like the Chesapeake Bay, that during the 20th century, the late 20th century, they became overwhelmed with nutrient inputs from human activities. Population growth to a certain degree, but the big factor was agriculture. We went into an industrial agriculture dependent upon not just, you know, recycling, you know, animal waste, but with commercial, industrially produced fertilizers. So around the world during that period, you saw dead zones develop. Our Chesapeake Bay, the Gulf of Mexico has a very massive dead zones, probably a record size this year because of all of the things that are going on down there with the hot Gulf temperatures that are fueling these floods and so on that are taking place. The Baltic Sea has a now permanent dead zone that it is present year round due to the activities of the nine nations around the Baltic in northern Europe. In many other areas in the world have this phenomenon. And we're all struggling. Baltic's got a program, just like we have in the Chesapeake Bay program, to reduce in half the amount of nutrients coming into it. The Mississippi Basin, which feeds the Gulf of Mexico, has a similar program. We are kind of at the cutting edge, though, of making progress and finding ways to do this. And so, interestingly, when I travel around the world, these other places, they all look to the Chesapeake Bay region and want to know what we're doing, how successful we are. So in a very real sense, the world is watching us.
Well, that's embarrassing if we have a record dead zone. And I do want to talk in a minute about what we're doing about it. But I want to ask you first, Tim Wheeler, is there an impact of a dead zone beyond the particular plants and animals in that area? And the dead zone goes from like just below the Bay Bridge down to about the state line, the Virginia line. That's the part of the bay we're talking about.
Mainly, I guess it extends. I mean, when it was at its worst this summer, it was actually below into Virginia.
Yeah.
Oh, it stretched far south.
Right. And as Don said, the dead zone itself is this sort of construct in a way. I mean, it's real, but it sort of bespeaks to this issue. Low oxygen levels can also impact the shallower waters. And so, you know, that same phenomenon, that same issue affects waters throughout the watershed to some degree. I think there's the fish kills are the obvious sign of, you know, something's wrong. But there's also sort of the subtle impact that all this must have on wildlife. I mean, if they're stressed, are they going to, you know, eat? Are they going to take care of themselves? Are they going to reproduce as much as they normally do? How much impact does this have on reproduction, on the ability of our commercial fisheries to sustain themselves? This is just a little anecdote. It probably has nothing. It may have nothing to do with it. I don't know. It's
we
maybe
love
coincidence.
Anecdotes. Sure, sure.
I decided it was time to, with all the good news about crabs, to have a crab feast with my family when we at the end of July. And so I called my favorite waterman and said, you know, I'd like to buy some of your crabs. And, he said maybe next week because his catch had just disappeared, virtually disappeared. And he said he promised me he would have some for me the next weekend. That was 2 weeks ago. And I went back to see him. And when I got there, he was very apologetic. He said, I don't have much for you. And what I did, most of it died before I got back to shore because of the heat. I mean, you know, the crabs were dying after he caught them because they were already stressed. And then they were in the hot boat. And, you know, and it took him a while to get back. But he just didn't catch as many as he'd been catching earlier in the summer. And
so just said heat.
Yeah.
You didn't specifically say lack of oxygen. So I want to make sure I'm understanding the import of this anecdote.
Could it be just the heat? Could it be the lack of oxygen? Think about this. If you're a critter that wants to, that needs to breathe oxygen in the water, and the deeper water doesn't have any, where are you going to hang out? Closer to the surface?
Where it's hotter.
Where it's hotter, okay? And we tend to wilt in the heat ourselves. I know I do, and try to get out of it. But when you can't, you're kind of stressed.
That is Tim Wheeler, managing editor of the Bay Journal, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also here with me is Dr. Don Bosch, president of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. We're talking about the Chesapeake Bay and the dead zone in it and how it grew this summer and now seems to have receded a bit. But what it means for the bay, for the health of the bay, for the creatures that live in it. Dana has called us from Baltimore. Dana, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello, Dana. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call today. I'm really glad you're talking about this on my lunch break. I just wanted to comment. I have been close to the water all my life, and one thing that I noticed last year, taking my family to Sandy Point for the first time in many years, was the lack of respect for the bay that the patrons shared. And the lack of enforcement regarding pollution. There were people throwing their trash on the beach, in the bushes, swimming with it in the water. And as soon as I noticed this myself, I pulled my family out of the water and we left. But before I left, I asked one of the lifeguards what they were doing to enforce it. And basically, they're not saying anything. They had a policy, he said, of not saying anything to the patrons, and there was a very big communication barrier regarding some of the patrons who, a lot of them were not from Maryland or from the United States. And I feel like if they don't know what they're doing and it's acceptable for them to swim in it and they're fine with throwing their trash on the ground, something needs to be done to prevent this. This is right at the water.
And you're talking about trash like cups and plates and that,
yes.
Bags,
and not
that kind
only,
of thing?
Oh, besides that, I stepped on a fish, a dead fish, undersized rockfish that somebody had pulled in. And I'm like, where's DNR? If we were out on our boat and we pulled in fish that were too small, we would really be fearful that we were going to get in trouble for that. Why? DNR is right down the street. Why is no one enforcing the rules?
Dana, I appreciate your calling. I'm not sure we can answer that question, but I'm wondering whether either Tim Wheeler or Don Bosch have a reaction to this story.
Well, you've got a couple of things going on there in terms of the enforcement side of things. The Natural Resources Police have the responsibility for maintaining the laws, enforcing the laws in the state parks and on the water. However, I will tell you that, I mean, their job is huge. They've got to cover the whole state and all of Maryland's part of the bay, and their numbers, their ranks are thinner than they've been in the past. And so there's a big challenge there for them in terms of having to deal with all this. On top of that, you see that there's been a real growth in attendance to state parks. The one near my house on weekends, they're my favorite part of Patapsco State Park. Sometimes I can't get into on weekends because it's just full. They close the gates and say there's no more places to park. That may be a function of the economy, maybe a function of people's you know, not having the expendable income to go to Ocean City or other places like that, or that they can't afford to go to a pool. That doesn't excuse throwing trash out, and somehow one needs to communicate the ethic there that's not a good thing, and it's self-destructive.
For sure.
Sure. Well, I think Tim said personal behavior. I mean, we can only save things that we care about, but also I think there are some challenges that we have to realize. It's not just the people who are attending beaches, but with respect to our environmental laws, our natural resource laws, the arms of the agencies, Department of Natural Resources, Department of the Environment, that are responsible for enforcement, have really been cut to the bone. They really are struggling with limited resources. And often when they get to a violation, they also had to deal with often very forgiving law. The court system has generally not been very aggressive in controlling violation of environmental and natural resource law. So all of those are challenges. Very important parts of the challenge. The legal enforcement issue is a key part of trying to restore the bay and have a more livable environment.
As Dr. Don Bosch, excuse me, Dr. Don Bosch is president of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. This is Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, and also with me here in the studio is Tim Wheeler, managing editor of the Bay Journal. We're taking your calls at 410-662-8780 and your emails at midday@wypr.org. John has called us from Baltimore with a point to make about Patapsco State Park. John, welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. Do you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you.
In relation to what the woman who called about the problem at Sandy Point State Park with the trash and cultural differences and stuff like that, I've kind of got a positive sort of story about that. My son and I, over the years, have gone to Patapsco State Park to swim in the river there. And I had not been in years, and I went maybe a month and a half ago with him. And he had talked about how there was so much trash there now, and it was horrible. There was trash. There were piles of trash. There were used, diapers and all kinds of stuff everywhere. And we kind of talked about it, and a lot of the people in the area where we were Hispanic immigrants, I assume, or they were Hispanic. I have spent a lot of time in Latin America. My son has too, and we really like Hispanic people, so we kind of made an effort to talk to him. And then my son went back a second time by himself. My son's like 26 or so, and he sort of went and hung out with a bunch of guys there. And he had taken a couple big garbage bags to pick up trash. And he talked to these guys about the problem. And they were like, oh, really? And they pitched in and helped, and they loaded up a couple big bags. And then, it just a small dent to the problem. But then my son said he went back a couple weeks later to the same area, and the whole area had been cleaned out. The Hispanic guys my son had first talked to the problem about said that they were going to pass the word and try to sort of get the whole community, the Hispanic community, to clean it up and take better care of it and stuff and sort of use peer pressure within their community. So sometimes maybe it's just a communication thing. It's certainly a cultural thing.
John, I appreciate.
In third world countries, everybody throws the trash everywhere. It's just what you do.
Well, I appreciate your sharing the good news of people getting each other engaged by talking to them. Thanks for that example. I want to, Tim Wheeler, ask you about. We've talked about the monumental effort to limit how many nutrients go into the bay. This is what's known as a pollution diet, right? Or at least that's one phrase of it. I've read that our neighbor Pennsylvania is way behind on controlling the amount of nutrients that Pennsylvania farmers and others are sending into the Susquehanna in particular, but the waterways that drain into the bay. What's going on with that?
Well, they've been under a lot of pressure to get with it, to get on the stick. This is a problem that has developed with them, for a number of years and through at least a couple of different administrations in Pennsylvania. You can imagine Pennsylvania is north of the bay. A lot of those people don't ever see the bay. It's a hard thing for them to connect that they need to care about it, politically speaking. And so that's been a challenge. They, like other states, have a lot of money problems, but they're behind. And so they've been getting increasing pressure from EPA, from the Environmental Protection Agency, which oversees this pollution diet, the total maximum daily load that requires all the Bay Watershed states to reduce their nutrient pollution. Just this year, the current administration announced that they were going to, their term, reboot their Bay cleanup effort, get it back on track, start to turn things around, turn the ocean liner, as one of their people put it to me, and that they were starting to do that. The challenge is that that needs, you know, there's nothing like money to make that sort of go. A lot of it is about staffing, getting people out there to talk to the farmers and inspect their farms. And they've had trouble getting that whole thing underway. They're getting more pressure from EPA. There was a recent letter from the EPA administrator to the governor there saying, you know, we're worried that your reboot is not rebooting. We want to see some progress. So the question will be, you know, how much progress can they make and how quickly are they going to be able to get back on track, and will there be, you know, consequences if they don't?
Well, and it seems to me there's kind of a larger question, I mean, related, larger question, because at the time, and you would remember the date, I don't, but when this, the latest plan of total maximum daily load pollution diet, we're really going to get serious about controlling pollution in the Bay, specifically the nutrients that deplete the oxygen. This is not going to be voluntary anymore, we were told. This is for real. This can be enforced. There's a hammer here. But it doesn't sound like anybody's banging a hammer to actually make something happen. I mean, how could this actually be enforced?
That's one of the challenges. I mean, when last year, this time, when it was, you know, becoming painfully clear that Pennsylvania was just way behind.
Behind all the other states.
Yeah, yeah. The EPA did withhold some money from them, a grand total of about $3 million that they gave them, typically gave the state money to help them with their Bay cleanup efforts. So it's a little bit
counterproductive
in that sense. But it was to send them a message, and it was embarrassing, and that was part of one of the things that maybe got them going, was this notion that they need to sort of show that they're not delinquent about this anymore. But the level of commitment that state needs to make is an order of magnitude higher than where they are right now. And the administration recognizes that. They've got to convince their legislators that they need more money. And that's part of the challenge.
Yeah, money is tight, obviously, everywhere. We need to take another short break. When we come back, I want to talk about climate change, how it brings warmer waters and rising sea levels, and what impact this will have on oxygen levels in the Bay. You are welcome to join this conversation. Do you think too much of the burden of cleaning up the Bay is falling on Maryland? Or do you think we get a lot of benefits and what we're being asked to do is just about right? You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the dead zone in Chesapeake Bay. I'm speaking with Dr. Don Bosch, president of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, and longtime environmental reporter, now managing editor for the Bay Journal, Tim Wheeler. You're welcome to be part of this conversation. What do you think state and local governments should be doing to combat the dead zone? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Don Bosch, I want to ask you about climate change, because we've made some references to the dead zone being exacerbated every summer by heat. You said it's actually been, I think you said, the size of it has been trending down, but then we still get these cyclical spurts of a dead zone. But what does climate change mean? I mean, I think we're all looking at, what is this going to mean?
Well, if we go back to how I tried to explain the fact that the warmer temperatures during the summer, which is when the dead zone occurs, or a factor both in terms of the increased stratification, less dense water on the top, warmer water and cooler water at the bottom, as well as the rate of decomposition. So normally you would think first principles that as climate changes, becomes warmer, the dead zones problem is going to be worse. And indeed, that is the general overall analysis that's basically very likely to happen. However, there are other factors that will play into that as our climate changes. First, as you mentioned, sea level is going to rise. Sea level, that means not only that some shorelines are going to be inundated, but the volume of the bay, total amount of water in the bay, increases because we've got another 2 or 3 feet of water on top of the water that's there. That has an effect in terms of the amount of water that has below the stratification level that has to be depleted in oxygen. It also has an effect so that the ocean tides have more of an influence on the bay, with more water moving in and out of the bay. So that generally could have an effect of reducing the dead zone effect. And then the most important factor, which is the one that we're most concerned about, is whether climate change will cause more rain, precipitation, and runoff into the bay. That carries more of the nutrients that are coming off of the land, but it also causes that surface water to become fresher, therefore that stratification increases. So the analyses this is an area of very active analysis right now by various scientific organizations and the Chesapeake Bay Program. And the analysis basically shows that, yes, as the bay is warmer, we expect, all of the things being equal, the dead zone will become bigger. But it's on a small level. The really big factor is that if rainfall and runoff in the spring and winter in particular becomes greater, then it's a really serious challenge. The problem we have as scientists is that of all of the things that we can predict about climate change, it's going to be warmer, sea level is going to be higher. We don't know, don't have that same level of confidence about precipitation and runoff. So the models show a wide range of effects. So it's an area where we're moving into a considerable uncertainty about our future. Are we going to have more intense rainfall events like we had in, it's happening down in Louisiana or in Ellicott City? Science is pretty clear that those will be more. But will we have more water running down the rivers into the bay? And by how much? We don't know that much yet.
Well, and one of the things I've heard associated with climate change, mm-hmm. Is the intensity of storms. In other words, perhaps you tell me, you're the scientist, you tell me whether overall there would be more precipitation. I think you just said that's not so clear. But we expect downpours. We expect flooding. We expect, a lot of water going into the bay more quickly, perhaps, than has been the pattern in previous decades. Will it have time to pick up nutrients as it flows into the bay, or will that somehow mean more nutrients are left back where they were put on the crops or someplace else and not end up in the bay?
That's a good question, and it depends on a little bit more detailed knowledge and description of where the nutrients are in the system, nitrogen and the phosphorus, than we have time to do. But take for example why this might seem to be inconsistent, but I can try to explain it. Take the floods in Louisiana right now. Mm-hmm. Actually,
that's your home state.
Yes, it is. So actually, the climate models that we have that show the long-term trends, actually having that part of the world actually becoming drier. But yet,
you could not tell anybody in Louisiana now.
But yet, that doesn't mean that you don't have more of these intense rainfall events. Why? First of all, the Gulf of Mexico waters become a lot warmer. It's like over 90 degrees, was over 90 degrees in the surface waters of the Gulf. That is the heat engine. That is also the source of the moisture, which comes down in rain. Secondly, the air temperatures have been warmer, so the air is holding more moisture. So it can build up to very high levels, concentrations of water vapor, and then whoosh, let them loose at once. So it's not inconsistent to think that overall we might have drier conditions unless the river runoff averaged over many years, but still have more of these extreme rainfall events, which tend to be You know, so for example, we had extreme rainfall in August here in the Maryland area, Ellicott City, and then more recent, you know, heavy runoff here. But you didn't in Pennsylvania. So from the Bay perspective and the dead zone perspective, it didn't matter that much because, you know, half of the watershed is in Pennsylvania. And all of the watershed, virtually all the watershed of the Susquehanna is there. So you got to think of the scale in which these phenomena are changing, both in time as well as in space.
Let's talk to Rebecca, who has called us from Baltimore. Rebecca, welcome to Midday. Rebecca?
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
This is not related. It's sort of a related. For years, I would go on the NOAA Chesapeake Bay, the NOAA Forecasting Sea Nettles website, where it had a map of the Chesapeake Bay and all the tributaries, and it would show you every single day what the hottest parts of the water were. And I used it to figure out where I was going to go swimming. You know, it would show you where the jellyfish, the sea nettles were. And it worked great, and it was up for years. And then about 2 years ago, they all of a sudden it stopped, and now it's a picture, and it says that the experimental probability forecast of sea nettles has been temporarily suspended. And I think that the reason why it was suspended, I called, and I can never get an answer for this. It worked so well, and I think it's because developers, like in St. Michael's and Cambridge, I think it's because they don't want people to see what's happening in the water or how many jellyfish there are or the dead zones because it impacts the real estate of, you know, people buying property on the water or them developing condominiums on the water or whatever.
Okay, and this was a tool by the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration?
Casting sea nettles.
Okay. Rebecca, I appreciate you raising it. Do either of you know about this tool? Do either of you know why it was taken down?
It was a tool that was developed actually in consultation and collaboration with some of my faculty members who had the knowledge to work with them to develop this forecasting. And it was a project. And so the project basically came to an end. NOAA went on to other things. Knowing the dynamics of these, the money, Tim is rubbing his fingers together, and knowing the dynamics of these things, I don't think that there was a conspiracy to put it off of the internet. I think it's just a question of they ran out of either money or attention over time to this issue. But it did work. You know, we had lots of positive comments about how well it was working in helping people, knowing whether they'd have to deal with jellyfish in the water.
It's one of the challenges that folks in Don's shop have and scientists and the folks who care about the Bay in general is that the available funding for this kind of thing is we're spending a lot of money, but there's money that needs to be spent to tell if the money we're spending is working. And sometimes the money for the science is thin, and it's episodic. I mean, another example like the one that she cited is that the Department of Natural Resources in Maryland used to have an Eyes on the Bay website that gave you some mm-hmm. pretty much real-time readings on harmful algal blooms, for instance, in the Bay.
And is there something like that that people can
well,
click on?
It's been down for a while. I haven't checked it in the last few weeks because it's been down for so long I've stopped looking at it regularly, but it was taken down for redesign, for update, and I think part of the issue is just the lack of resources and staff to be able to do everything that they need to do.
So if people are interested in that kind of thing, they should let somebody know who? Their state legislator? Call the Department of Natural Resources?
Well, I think you could, first of all, you could go to this Eyes on the Bay, that's what it is, Eyes on the Bay, one word, website, and
EyesOnTheBay.gov?
I don't know.
We will check.
Just
and
Google Eyes on the Bay.
Yes,
and you will. This is the source. For example, they're the ones who are putting forth these new surveys that are done every 2 weeks on the dead size of the dead zone. You'll find information about that, but also I think there's probably a response site so you can, you know, respond on that email site. Let them know your concerns, and maybe they can tell you when they plan to have it back up. Because I think Tim is right. I think it was a redesign issue. Rather than totally off the air. I think they're still collecting the data, but they haven't gotten a new interface to provide users the information yet.
EyesOnTheBay.net.
There you go.
Our crack staff has checked this out. We're down to just a couple of minutes. I want to share what Craig emailed us. I recently moved from Madison, Wisconsin, where they had algae blooms in the four lakes surrounding the city. One thing they did to reduce algae blooms was to eliminate phosphorus by banning fertilizer. Are there any movements afoot to do something along those lines? Craig from Baltimore.
Well, that's a whole different show. But, yeah, we've done things to deal with phosphorus. For one, in terms of lawn fertilizer, you're not supposed to be able to buy lawn fertilizer with phosphorus in it unless you're starting a lawn. There are regulations effective in Maryland now that actually sort of restrict your use of it here. And they're supposed to be there at time of year application, too. You're not supposed to put it down too late in the summer or too late in the fall or start it too early in the spring that it would wash off. There are regulations applied and being applied in Maryland that are being phased in dealing with the use of animal manure, which is rich in phosphorus and nitrogen on farmland, because that was, again, has been an issue of phosphorus levels building up in farmland on the Eastern Shore primarily, but also in other places of the state where they have used this again and again, way beyond the capacity of the crops to use it. And it tends to run off after time. So there are things being done. There's more that needs to be done.
Another show, we couldn't ban it.
Yeah.
Okay. Real quickly, before I let you go, we're down to just a minute. What is the Bay Journal working on in its next issue?
Well, I'm personally working on a story looking at an issue that's fascinated me for a time. One of the big activities here to try to help deal with degraded waterway streams and rivers is stream restoration. And there's been a lot of research on that, some of it being done by folks at the University of Maryland at UMSES and other places. And so I'm going to look at an update on that.
We will be reading that. I appreciate your spending the hour with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tim Wheeler is managing editor of the Bay Journal, and Dr. Don Bosch is president of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. Thanks.
It's good to be here again. Thanks.
And thank you for listening. Tune in Monday. Sudden memory loss fascinates us because perhaps in many ways we are our memories. What remains when your memory is gone? We'll listen back to a conversation with neuropsychologist Dr. Jason Brandt. I'm Sheila Cast. I hope you have a great weekend.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.